A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 177. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are continuing our discussion of She-Wolf of London. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
So this was an unusual occult or supernatural investigation show from 1990 and 91. It ran for 20 episodes, and it was released in the end by Universal Studios Television Productions. So it was actually released in the US.
That's right. Although it was shown here on the Sky One network in the UK, and as we discussed last time, it was a co-production with a British company, although the British backers did pull out at some point during that, because perhaps wasn't going as well as they'd hoped. But more of that later.
Yes, and of course in the US it was known as Love and Curses.
That's right, so a different title over there. And last time we talked about the setup, and in particular the first 14 episodes, this young American student coming to England to study mythology. She's bitten by a werewolf, so she has a nice welcoming committee for her.
Yes, very much so. And she teams up with her university professor to investigate the paranormal. And as they go along, they are also looking for a cure for her condition or her curse, being a werewolf.
Yes, and all of this set in a very sort of stereotypical-looking England, that sort of Americanized version of old London town that we sometimes see in film and television, and used as the background for a series of largely one-off cases of a supernatural nature that they basically look into one a week.
Yes, that's right.
Now, we know that it had European producers and financial backing, and we know that some of that was from the ITV company HTV. As I say, it's a bit of a mystery as to when that was withdrawn, but at some point during the production of the first 14 episodes, I guess the European backers said that they were pulling out.
Yes, that's right. So you had it really being produced by a British team and as a British production for 14 episodes, and then the American creators of the show, after those 14 episodes, moved the whole thing to Los Angeles. And you had a show that was now set in LA that had the two main characters from the earlier episodes and a little bit of their story and their backstory going with them. But mostly it was a new American show that ran for 6 episodes that involved these two characters. And what one thread that they had brought over from the British show was the idea that Professor Ian Matheson had this book that was this originally going to be this sort of academic book about mythology and was somehow along the way turned into a very lurid, sex-driven piece of fiction somehow, and turns into a bestseller. So he has now been invited to host this paranormal talk show in LA.
Yes, that's right. I can't actually remember what the terrible title they give his book. But yes, what seems to be a sort of fairly serious academic book gets given a terrible title and a lurid cover. And as a result of which, he's moved to Los Angeles, where it becomes a small hit. And he's given this TV show. And that, as we say, lets them carry on with their strange investigations. And, you know, various things happen through the TV show, but also through their new Los Angeles lifestyle. And we have to say, I mean, it does seem like it becomes almost a different show for these last six episodes. It becomes very Los Angeles. They drive a very snazzy car. Ian in particular gets a very sort of Los Angeles makeover with some very sharp suits for the period of time. And the sort of vaguely flirtatious and perhaps we should say inappropriate relationship they had as a student and a teacher in the first 14 episodes, well, any sort of pretense is abandoned for the last six episodes. They're sort of fully in an actual relationship with each other. So the student-teacher problem seems to have been overcome when he presumably gives up his university post and moves to Los Angeles to be a TV presenter.
Yes, they do mention that he's now no longer a professor and she's no longer a student, and they are very clearly a couple at this point. I believe the book that he had written ended up being called Satan's Sex Slaves.
That sounds like the correct one. That's the one, yes. Which we can see how that might become a...
Yeah, it was this odd thing from the first 14 episodes, the British run of it, where it was supposedly this dry academic title that Aunt Elsa comes in as editor or co-author or something and helps turn it into this popular thing so he can make a bunch of money from that and go off to LA and so on. And they do, from time to time, mention the book later on in the American episodes.
Yes, you're quite right. It was Aunt Elsa who came up with the shocking title based on some of the shocking magazines and sort of bodice rippers that she liked to read herself.
Yeah, it was just very odd.
Yeah.
So we sometimes like to bring things into a bit of context with other shows and other series that have gone on with similar themes. And one that seems to come up a few times is the idea of a man and a woman together investigating the supernatural or the occult, the paranormal, those sorts of things. And we had a good look at this with The Omega Factor from 1979. We covered that way back in British Invaders 23 and 24. And that was a much more serious look at the paranormal, but it had that dynamic of the man and the woman sort of going into different situations and seeing what was going on and investigating things. And of course, in the US, we would see the X-Files, starting in 1993, use a similar sort of thing, probably the definitive duo for this sort of investigation series. And it had a bit of a similar vibe to The Omega Factor, although it was certainly very original and quite different from that as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've said it before, it's quite interesting how often this theme has come up as a television idea. And here we see another early stab at it from She-Wolf of London. And of course, we've mentioned the one it perhaps most resembles, which is Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which came along 1997, I believe, as late as that, where, again, you perhaps had a similar but less inappropriate relationship between Buffy and an academic, in the case of Giles, who knew most of the sort of mythology history of the stuff that she was fighting. Plus you've got the add-on Scooby gang sort of expanding the cast, but it shared I think some of the slightly comedic elements of She-Wolf of London. You can see some parallels, though, as we've said, it's done much better by Joss Whedon and the others on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think the view of the supernatural and how different things turn up when they're investigating in She-Wolf of London is sort of reminiscent of what they would do in the early days of Buffy later on.
Yes. Yes, it is very, you know, you can certainly see some parallels when you watch both. But should you watch She-Wolf of London at all? Well, we'll sort of get to that in a moment.
Yes, we should sort of talk about the good and the bad here. So, Eamon, what did you like about She-Wolf of London?
Well, let's start at the beginning when it starts off as a werewolf show. And if I can get past the sort of Hollywood version of London, England, to look at the setup of the story and to look at some of the early episodes dealing with creepy and supernatural goings on, as you've said, Brian, the cinematography, the look of it is not too bad in those early episodes. It looks like it's trying to be a creepy show and it's managing reasonably well.
Yeah, this was an HTV production at the beginning, and I believe it may have had some of the same people working on the visuals as Robin of Sherwood had. I'm not positive about that, although Patrick Gromgul was involved with both of them. But it had a reminiscent approach to the cinematography, which I thought was quite beautifully shot when they were doing the creepy and supernatural things. And I thought the look of the she-wolf and the look of the transformation was really quite well done. I like those.
Yes, they keep the werewolf shots to a minimum, and they keep her, you know, mostly in darkness or so on. But of course, when they do have to show her, it's not too bad. There are occasionally some moments when the shaggy suit and the 80s hairstyle that seems to go with it are a bit rubbish. But early on, the moments of the werewolf transformation and actually seeing her, that was quite good.
Yeah, I thought those things worked well, and the look of it at that point in the series was pretty good. Some of the ideas of the things they were investigating, some of the supernatural things that came up with it, were also kind of interesting ones. Some of them were not bad.
Yeah, it's not too bad. I mean, as you say, there's some vampires, there's some zombies, there's haunted bookshops, there's various curses, there's circuses turn up at a variety of points. There's a spoof of a fairly well-known television science fiction show from America. Some of the ideas, not too bad at all, although I think the writing, let's be fair and call it variable. Some of the episodes, not quite as good as the others, Brian.
Yes, variable may be slightly generous, actually. Where this starts to fall down, I think, is with the central characters. And it's both the dialogue and the performances that, you know, have to go with this. The characters as they're defined are just not very well done and actually not very easy to watch in many cases. It starts to become a little bit cringeworthy when Ian and Randy and the rest of the Matheson family, in some cases, are involved. And some of the writing can be really quite problematic, I found.
Yes, for a show that doesn't start off too badly, it does, as you say, become more and more difficult to find the good points in it as the series progresses. You know, not the least because some of the writing is so over the top, some of the acting heads in that direction as well. And, you know, certain features of the setup are just a bit creepy. And I don't mean creepy in the right way. You know, the relationship between a professor and a student and the fact that he has this basement dungeon, which he can chain her up in, is all done slightly ridiculous, I suppose, in a way, Brian.
Yeah, it's a little bit like it's trying to be a comedy at the same time as it's trying to be this creepy supernatural show. And the comic elements, for me, just didn't work.
No, it does try its hand at comedy quite a lot. And by and large, it isn't funny as a show. It isn't funny at all, particularly the first 14 episodes. When it tries, I think it fails. What about the actors, particularly the central actors? Were they problematical for you?
They were okay. I think the problem was what they were being put into, you know, forced them to start going into these big, over-the-top, stereotypical kinds of performances and characters, especially for Ian Matheson. And that just didn't make it very interesting to watch.
Yeah, it is a tricky one. I mean, they've both gone on to have very successful careers elsewhere, so they're presumably pretty good. But this strange relationship between the two of them, the daft situations they're put into, the weird writing they have to deal with, this show that's not quite sure what it wants to be, and is trying to have this sort of flirtatious, cheeky relationship between the two leads, a sort of, dare I say it, a sort of full moonlighting seems to be what they're trying for, but it doesn't seem to work.
The character of Ian Matheson is just not a likable character, and he needs to be a likable character because he's one of the two main characters of the show, and that brings it down a lot.
Yes, I mean, he has none of the sort of gravitas or likability of Anthony Head, I think it is, as Giles in Buffy.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, doesn't quite work. I have to say that for a werewolf show, I should also point out, we don't see an awful lot of werewolf. She doesn't transform all that often, does she, Brian?
That's right. She sort of does from time to time, and quite a number of times, but they sort of gradually build into the show that she transforms with the full moon, but, oh, when this happens, she also transforms. And when that happens, she also transforms. When there's magic involved, she might also transform. So on and so forth. Which felt a little bit like they knew they needed more werewolf and they were making it up as they went along. I don't know if that was actually the case, but that's sort of how it seemed at that point.
Right. Okay.
And then by the time we get to the American version of the show, it seems like it sort of tosses the idea of being, you know, this sort of creepy kind of supernatural show and goes for a more monster of the week kind of series.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
With each episode bringing in a different monster, usually a sort of well-known mythological kind of monster, but, you know, one after another after another. And they introduce this terrible idea that whenever Randy starts to make out with Ian, she starts to transform. And they can't be physically close because she will start to transform into a werewolf anytime they're close.
Right. It's a very glossy looking last six episodes. You know, it's very Los Angeles, flashy cars, flashy costumes, a lot of actors with flashy haircuts. It, as you say, it does seem to give up on any pretense at all of being a serious show at this point and tries to play it entirely for laughs for the last six episodes. Sometimes with reasonable effects. I quite liked the black and white episode, which is called Bride of the Wolfman. I've just watched that one today, and that wasn't too bad, actually, where they find themselves trapped in an old Universal Studios horror movie by some convoluted bit of television nonsense, but there you go. But that wasn't too bad.
That was the most interesting of the American episodes. And it brought in Tony Amendola, probably best known from Stargate SG-1, as sort of the mad scientist type character from this old black and white movie. And that, you know, sort of getting into episodes that we did like, that was sort of the cleverest and most interesting of the American episodes, I think.
Okay. What about the best ones from the British episodes?
Well, there was a two-parter called You Can't Keep a Dead Man Down. I kind of enjoyed some things in that. That sort of dips into zombie mythology, but not quite. And that had some things in it that were not bad. I enjoyed parts of that.
Yeah, that was all right, actually. A two-parter. I think it's the only two-parter, but it's pretty good. The Bookshop of Horrors, or Little Bookshop of Horrors, wasn't too bad with the idea of this of cursed books. But apart from that, I was struggling to pick one out from the earlier episodes.
I thought the circus episode, Big Top She-Wolf, was kind of interesting in some ways. In particular, that early performance by Jason Carter, who would go on to be in Babylon 5 as a regular for some time, when, you know, once he had moved to the U.S. That was interesting to see his performance. So that one had some things that were not bad in it as well.
Okay. So, some moments as we've gone through, but perhaps not as many as we'd like for a show of this length, Brian.
That is quite true. So, our recommendations. Do you want to start this one off, Eamon?
Oh dear, do I have to start, Brian? Okay. She-Wolf of London is terrible. I thought we'd be hard-pressed to beat Star Maidens for the worst show that we've reviewed. But it's terrible, I'm afraid. It starts out being pretty bad. It gets more and more ropey as it goes along. And then when it moves to Los Angeles, it just gives up all attempts at being anything decent and tries to play it for laughs, which mostly don't succeed. So my recommendation would be, no, don't watch it. Go and watch Star Maidens. Brian.
Yeah, I'm going to fit in with that. I can't recommend this. It was really not a very good show. Maybe if you can take a look at the British and American versions of the title sequence for those first 14 episodes and get a bit of an idea of the visuals, that might be kind of fun. But beyond that, it's not a show that I would recommend.
Okay, so do have a look at the title sequences. Tell us if there's a worse title sequence in any of the British Invader shows that we've yet covered. Tell us if Brian and I are completely wrong about this show and that actually it's a good show. And if so, you know, tell us why you like it. Do send us some feedback. Come in on email or come and join us on the Facebook group and tell us about this show.
Yes, we would love to hear some feedback about why She-Wolf of London is a great show. So, in summary, She-Wolf of London was a show that gave us Randy Wallace, an American student who goes to England to work on her master's in mythology, and is very soon bitten by a werewolf and becomes a werewolf herself. And along with her professor and possibly or possibly not romantic interest, Ian Matheson, they are looking for a cure for her and also running a little paranormal investigation service on the side in the hopes of finding a cure. And they go on through these types of things for 14 episodes set in the UK and produced in the UK. And the series at that point moves to the US and does 6 episodes that are set and produced in LA, which feature Ian Matheson, now no longer a professor, but someone who was hosting a paranormal TV series, and Randy Wallace also working behind the scenes on that series, continuing to investigate the paranormal and search for a cure to Randy's werewolf curse.
Okay, it's a show that we perhaps stretched a point to include because we wanted to have a look at it. Now we're sort of regretting that we did, but as ever, come and tell us what you thought.
Well, maybe so. It is something that is very different from most other things that were being done at the time or at most any time in the UK. So it's interesting to see that for contrast to so many other things in supernatural and science fiction and related genres.
Okay. And for more contrast, come back and join us next time when we're perhaps on safer ground, Brian. We're back in the 1970s with another slice of ITV sort of classic children's adventure series with a science fiction theme, a show called The Jensen Code. Should be something interesting to talk about there.
Yes, interesting stuff in that one, and definitely a shift for sure. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at BritishInvaders.com. We are part of the Geek Culture Network, so if you go to thegeekculturenetwork.com, you can find us there. We also have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find that. And we have plenty of discussion with quite a few different listeners about Doctor Who and about British science fiction and related genre shows of all sorts.
Yes, that's right. Quite a lot going on in the Facebook group at the moment. And we're also to be found howling out on VogNetwork.com, which is the Voice of Geeks streaming radio on the internet. You will find many geek-related shows there, of which British Invaders is just one. We have a Monday and a Tuesday slot, and as ever, we welcome all Vogue Network listeners aboard.
Yes, absolutely. That also gives you a chance to listen to us and join in with a chat network where you can have a conversation that you can type back and forth with while listening to us, which is quite fun. And yeah, please join us in those places. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much, and until next time, it's Eamon in England saying, oh!